Very, very much welcome to the seminar, which is kind of Minding the Woman's Health Gap. So our alumni, I mean, for a university that is only 60 years old, we've got an alumni community now, which is more than 300,000. I think the last count was about 310,000, which is great. And as can be seen from the places on the chat, is a very much a global network and community. So I am Rachel Sammy Thomas. I am the registrar at the university, which at a high level truth means I'm responsible for the non-academic side of the university, so professional services. And this webinar is going to explore global women's health and why there is a gap, why it persists, and the personal and societal impacts of those unequal health outcomes, as well as the urgent need for more research and innovation. And we're going to talk about how we are trying to build up a pipeline of women's health experts to examine the steps that need to be taken to create a kind of lasting impact. So I would very much like to welcome our expert panelists and ask them to say a few words about themselves, including a physical description. So I will kick off. I am, well, you can't tell that I'm small. I'm only 5'1½, and I've even made it to 5'2", and I've got short blonde curly hair. I'm sitting down wearing a turquoise dress with a pale lemony type of background. So, Georgina, can I ask you to kick off and say a couple of words?
Hi, my name is Georgina Eku Adewothuoli, better known as Eku Adewo. I'm a filmmaker, actor, presenter, and model. I'm deeply passionate about amplifying Nigerian creative voices and building collaborative bridges between Nigeria and the UK. Following my own recent health journey, I experienced firsthand the gaps in women's healthcare, and I have since dedicated myself to being an advocate for this cause. I'm a proud Warwick alumna. I am 5'10", so a bit taller than you, Rachel. I'm female. I'm in my 30s. I'm a mixed race British Nigerian. And today I have short brown hair and I'm wearing a burgundy top. I'm sitting in a white room with a lovely burgundy piece of art.
Perfect. Thank you, Erin.
Hi, thanks, Rachel. I'm Erin Greaves. I'm a female in her early 40s. I've got mid-length red hair. I'm also short, 5'3". And I'm channeling my inner spring today. I've got a yellow and blue summer dress on. And I'm in my home office, unfortunately not showing the books, but instead the board games. I'm a professor at Warwick Medical School, where I co-lead the Women's Health Mission and the Centre for Early Life. And my research focuses on endometriosis, an extremely common and debilitatingly painful condition that affects millions of women. And the work that we do is to look at the immune system, so the body's natural defense, and how that might actually encourage the development of endometriosis if it gets dysregulated. So our goal is to better understand how endometriosis starts, but also why it continues, so that we can understand better ways to diagnose it without having to rely on surgery, but also to treat it without having to rely on surgery or hormones. But ultimately, our research is to improve the lives of women living with the condition.
Thank you. Andrew, last but not least.
Thank you, Rachel. Yeah, and great to see so many people here today. So my name is Andrew McCainch. I'm male. I have sitting in my room down here with my whiteboard behind me with some nice chromosomes drawn on it. I've just noticed, which I'll tell you about in a minute. I am wearing glasses. I have no hair whatsoever, and I have broken the 50-year barrier and still enjoying life. So it's great to see everybody here today. I actually am also the deputy dean in the medical school, and I'm also the pro dean for research. That means I'm in charge of trying to develop and build our research strategy in the Warwick Medical School. But more importantly than that, I'm a scientist. I'm a molecular biologist by training. And I'm really interested and have been for the last 20 or so years in understanding how the cells of your body divide and how when they divide, they make sure that they put the right numbers of chromosomes in the right cell. This is really important because if this goes wrong, this leads to lots of problems. One you might be most familiar with is Down syndrome, where you end up with three copies of chromosome 21. So my research has been interested in understanding how that works and how cells do this, but most recently realizing that the wrong numbers of chromosomes is also really closely related to infertility and also, sadly, pregnancy loss. And so the lab is now trying to understand how we might understand why that happens, and maybe we can find ways to intervene and improve outcomes for patients. So I think that's why I'm here today. I'm really excited to talk about women's health. It's much more than reproductive biology. I think we're going to talk about that as we go forward. And so hopefully this can be a really useful and productive meeting for everyone. Thanks, Rachel.
Well, absolutely. Well, with those introductions, I'm even more excited than I already was to be listening to what you have to say. So the way we're going to run it is we asked you for questions in advance. We got fabulous ones. It was really difficult to choose which ones to expand on. But anyway, but we have done it. So we have a number of questions, and I'm going to put them to the panelists and get their views. So the first one, I mean, I mentioned earlier on in my introduction about the fact that there is a woman's health gap. So Erin, could you just elucidate for us what we actually mean when we say that?
Yeah, absolutely. So for a long time, medicine has treated the male body as default. So the women's health gap is basically the consequences of that. When women's biology, symptoms, and diseases are not studied or recognized in the same way. So it refers to the systemic differences in how diseases affecting women are researched, diagnosed, and treated. And this leads to poorer health outcomes. For women.
Yeah, I think also worth adding, I always think the great context to this whole thing is to say that women are 51% of our population. So this is an important thing to keep in mind as we go forward and talk about these issues. So we're talking about the majority of people on the planet. So it is extremely important that we understand why this health gap actually exists. And, you know, it's actually shocking. So women spend, it is now known, 9 additional years in poor health when compared to men. And you all know that actually women on average live longer. So what this means is we end up in a situation where women have a longer lifespan, but actually a shorter health span. And I think what we want to do here is try to understand why that has happened, and most importantly, what can we actually do about it? Now, these differences are often avoidable, and much of it's actually driven by bias, underrepresentation, or even like structural inequalities, not just biology alone. The other thing that's really important to say is that this gap, it doesn't just deal with adults. So girls, adolescents are also impacted through delayed diagnosis, dismissal of symptoms, and the lack of age-appropriate care. And actually, this shapes the outcomes across that whole life course for those girls. So, what do women need from healthcare, and what can a healthcare system currently deliver, and how can we try to change that? And so, I think one thing we, Erin and I, have been talking about a lot is to try to understand what are actually the causes of this, because we've just painted a picture that doesn't look right. So, we first need to understand the causes, and then I think we obviously need to think about how we can make things better. So, maybe Erin, you can tell us what you think some of the causes are from your perspective.
So, as Andrew very briefly mentioned, some of the main causes include historical bias in medical research. So, for decades, clinical trials enrolled mostly men, and many animal studies also only used male mice. So, the female body was perceived as too complex to study because of the menstrual cycle, fluctuations in hormones, but also concerns about the impacts of experimental medicine on pregnancy and reproductive health. So this means that many of the disease mechanisms in women are less well understood. Treatments might be less effective, and drug dosing often less precise. But also, diseases that impact both men and women look different in women. So medical training has historically focused on male symptoms, but it's actually well known now that things like heart attacks, autoimmune disease, chronic pain conditions actually look and present differently in women. So this can lead to women being mi misdiagnosed or diagnosed later. There's also an under-recognition of diseases that primarily or uniquely impact women, so conditions like endometriosis, adenomyosis, menopause-related conditions, and also chronic pelvic pain. So they've historically received less funding, but also significantly less attention as well, which contributes to long diagnostic delays, fewer treatment options, limited understanding of the underlying biology, but also stigma. But also, one of the main things is that the women's health gap doesn't impact all women the same. So inequalities related to ethnicity, socioeconomic status, geography, disability can also further widen the disparities. So when we talk about the women's health gap, it's really important to recognize that some groups of women face additional barriers, meaning that the gap is often even wider for those already experiencing social or economic disadvantage. So, for example, a recent report highlighted that across the UK, it takes about 8 years for a woman with endometriosis to receive a diagnosis. But actually, a more recent report that was put together by the Sisters Organisation and Endometriosis UK, they actually found that in ethnically diverse communities, that diagnostic delay is actually 11 years. So closing the women's health gap means recognizing that some groups face even greater barriers and committing to a future where those inequalities are no longer accepted. Sorry, I wanted to take this opportunity to mention that today, whilst we refer to women's health, because the vast majority of people who will encounter what we are discussing will identify as women, we also want to highlight that women's health research, interventions and services are also needed by and should include people that are transgender, non-binary, as well as those with variations in sex characteristics and those who are intersex.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously a really, really complex area with, lots of historical and systemic roots. So I'm going to ask Georgina a question, which, apologies, Georgina, because it might sound as if it's a really stupid, obvious question, but, why is it so important that we should address these?
So I'm going to make this, I think the most impact I can bring to this discussion is my personal journey. So today I sit as a female health advocate, speaking from the most critical perspective of all, which is the patients. My journey actually began at the end of 2021 when I discovered a small breast lump. A month later, it was still there. While working on set in Lagos as a producer, a vivid, intrusive thought struck me: what if this is more? I walked off that set and straight into a women's clinic. Though the nurse told me she didn't feel anything worrisome, my intuition. Private diagnostic hospital in Lagos. There, I underwent the standard battery of tests, mammogram, ultrasound, followed by an agonized 10-day wait, and the verdict arrived via Zoom from a UK-based breast specialist. It was just a fibroadenoma, common, harmless, and nothing to worry about. I moved on with my life, unaware that 2 years later, fueled by the stresses of work and life, that that harmless lump would grow until it was visible, accompanied by a new ominous swelling under my armpit. So when I called to book a follow-up, the shift in tone was immediate. The doctor's face was now etched with worry. He knew, and a week later, after I had a biopsy, I knew too that I had breast cancer. So we are constantly told that early detection saves lives, but what did that mean when the system, what does that mean when the system fails you? I realized I had entrusted my life to specialists who hadn't taken my concerns seriously. I booked an immediate flight home to the UK, and in the UK, I found my first glimmer of hope. My surgeon looked at the lump and said, something that changed everything for me. I think we can fix this. However, my oncologist was less optimistic. Based on initial tests, she believed I had distant lymph node involvement, secondary incurable breast cancer. My surgeon disagreed. When the biopsies came back, his theory was proven correct. The cancer was positive only in my local nodes, so it was locally advanced. But my oncologist disagreed, and she remained unconvinced, arguing that biopsies weren't always accurate. And I found myself in a tug of war between two specialists while I, the third specialist in the room, was silenced. I was the only one who could truly feel what my body was going through. Yet when I spoke, I was met with patronizing, sympathetic eyes as if I were a mental health patient rather than a woman fighting for her physical survival. Labeled inoperable, I realized I had to become my own advocate. My oncologist followed everything by the book, so I thought I would read every book myself. I scoured the internet for stories of survival and doctors who viewed patients as partners. I found a community of voices that gave me the second opinion the clinic maybe wouldn't. Dr. Eleonora Toplinski, she's on Instagram. Dr. Elizabeth Komen writes about, recently published a book, It's All in Her Head. Dr. Lisa Ryden, who's a breast cancer survivor. Annie Bond, Brittany Beadle, and I also found Diana Donnelly, whose bi breast cancer page showed me that even a metastatic diagnosis wasn't always the end. I wondered, why wasn't my clinical team bringing hope to the table? I decided then that I would trust the voice within me, the same voice that sent me running to the clinic years ago, now whispered, "You will be fine." When I asked how I could support my own healing, my oncologist told me there was no evidence that anything outside conventional medicine could help. She suggested acupuncture only for symptom relief. That suggestion led me to a traditional Chinese medicine doctor. She assessed me, required weekly visits, and insisted on lifestyle changes to manage stress. Ironically, with a doctor whose first language wasn't English, I finally felt truly heard. I pursued an integrative path. So I combined conventional treatment with diet, exercise, acupuncture, and Chinese medicine. I supported my mental health with regular church visits, prayer, and many sessions with my amazing therapist, Therese. Within 5 months, I was restaged back to locally advanced. 11 months later, the same oncologist who doubted me delivered the news there was no evidence of disease. Suddenly, she was the one convincing me that I was fine. When I returned to my surgeon, he marveled at my recovery, acknowledging that I had beaten the odds. He even suggested I thank my traditional Chinese medicine doctor for her role in my healing. After a curative mastectomy and radiation, my recent PET scan remains clear, and almost 2 years ago, I was theoretically incurable, and today I'm cancer-free. So I am reclaiming my life every single day. Looking back, the hardest part wasn't the chemo or the surgery or the radiation. It was not being heard. It was the feeling that I had nothing to contribute to my own recovery. I may not have a medical degree, but I do have a PhD in my own survival. I am grateful to my medical team, but I must leave the medical field with this. It is vitally, vitally important to listen to your female patients. See the person, not just the presentation of symptoms. When you hear us, you aren't just being polite. You are finding the missing clues to better outcomes and saved lives. Thank you.
My word, that is an incredible story. Absolutely incredible. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. And what a fantastic ending to it. Because I, one stage I was feeling really panicked. But anyway, and absolutely, and I love that, you see the kind of your PhD in your own body. I mean, absolutely so much of that. So obviously, we at Warwick are trying our best to do what we can. So can you share with us, Andrew and Erin, why you think we are so exceptionally well placed to do that?
Well, just to say, Georgina, your story is incredible, and
Incredible.
you have been extremely also brave to come and share it with everyone here. And actually, the amount of good it does to share such stories,
Right.
it's a very powerful thing. I think what you're saying, though, resonates with what we hear all over, everywhere in women's health space. The fact that women and girls feel like they just aren't always listened to and taken seriously. And I think this is a major issue. It's why I think that we need to put women, patients, people at the heart of this, what we're trying to do, be, make them part of our research programs, why we're doing it, and involve them in all steps along that journey. I think that is super important. And I think that is something that will make Warwick really stand out here. I think we're going to put that at the front of what we're doing, not as a afterthought to what we are doing, which is what I think sadly happens in many situations. So yeah, I do. One of the big problems that we have, Georgina, and breast cancer is a terrible disease that we need to make more progress on in terms of screening for breast cancer and in improving treatments and outcomes. But the truth is that research funding for women's health is just tiny in comparison to the greater. I think it's something like only 5% of R&D money goes to women's health research, right? So we are, these conditions deeply affect all of us, people we know, people we care and love. I have my wife, I have my daughters, they have challenges. My wife has had endometriosis. I know what it looks like firsthand. It's a really debilitating disease that really, really pushes people's quality of life down. And these could be, we could deal with these things, but we need to do more work to do that. And I think that's why, as Erin pointed out, we sort of set up this mission to try to do that, try to bring people together, because it's not going to be just the scientists and the clinicians. It's also going to be the patients and the public and all the other expertise that we have around us that can come together so that we can actually make some real progress. So I think that's what I think we should put at the heart of what we're trying to do.
Yeah, patients first, absolutely. And that patient involvement being absolutely key. So, Georgina, can I ask? So, if other women, including any of the women who are also on this call, experience that same feeling of not being listened to, have you got advice about them about how they can cope and turn it around in the same way that you managed to turn it around?
Yes, I think that I think as women, we are very good at being stoic. And I know that when I was I didn't want to be seen as hysterical.
Right.
And I would say, I don't think one needs to lose their head, but I do think speaking up is extremely important and being very clear and vocal. And not being embarrassed. Interestingly for me, when I was dealing with, like I said, when I was dealing with my doctors and they had given me one diagnosis, it was like talking to a wall. And it's almost like they didn't want me to walk the path of hope.
Yeah, which is astonishing, isn't it? Because,
And
because of
that.
the mental attitude.
Yeah, it was more sort of like that was a more dangerous thing to consider. Look at the facts, look at the presentations. And and what I learned from so many other patients was that you end up becoming better informed than a lot of clinicians that you come in contact with, because you spend the hours and hours reading the literature, following the research, finding the clinical trials, speaking to listening and fi seeking out lead oncologists in their field and lead surgeons, and you hear what they're saying doesn't match up with what you're hearing in the
Yeah.
office or in your clinic. You're hearing people are making huge breakthroughs, and you learn about not experimental drugs that have just passed approval and are making massive impact, and you realize that the field of there's more options out there, or there are people and individuals pushing to get more, and you could be part of that. So I think it's important to speak up, and if you don't feel that you're being heard, to if you have the possibility, get another opinion or look for more opinions.
Yeah, and presumably share your story so that you can benefit from the wisdom of others.
Yeah, I think sharing. I'm typically not a very vocal person. I don't talk about my private life a lot. And finding another mother, because I have a child, I have a 9-year-old. I found a mother who had had, I mentioned her, Diana, who had had metastatic breast cancer whilst she was pregnant. and it had gone to her liver and her lungs, and she's
Lord.
7 years, and able to speak to her, to someone else that had gone through a more serious diagnosis in its spread, and was doing well, was really important as well. And to find this community of women that were doing amazing things, and I could get hope from.
So I'm going to slightly go off topic because I know we're mainly concentrating on the research that you two are doing, but you did mention, Andrew, that you're dean of the medical school. So I'm just kind of hoping that we are teaching our medical students to, treat patients with the respect and dignity that they deserve, that patients deserve, especially female
Yeah,
medical.
I mean, I very much hope and think that we are, and I think that we have what is the Warwick Doctor. I think they're very special. I think they're different, and I think these sorts of things are at the heart of the kind of doctor that we're trying to launch out into the world from Warwick, and I think we should continue to do so. I think part of what we've been thinking about, though, is there's a lot about training and understanding and improving knowledge at multiple levels. So there's the public understanding of what's happening here in women's health. There's also the training and the expertise know-how for your GP, so they are equipped to understand and to discuss and refer in the right ways, right through to the more acute care. And so at all levels, I think that this sort of education and understanding needs to be improved. I think that if you look at even the government's women's health strategy, it's sort of laid bare there, and the kinds of stories that we're hearing today are also in there. They talk to 100,000 women, and you can just read the stories, and it is shocking to believe that we're in the situation that we are. So I think that that education piece actually is really important, and as a university, as a medical school, it's something that we should have responsibility for trying to work on and to improve.
And I mean, I would imagine from all of the kind of the stories that are gathered and the stories that we will all hear talking to our friends, there do seem to be additional barriers for women accessing health care. So I was kind of wondering, Erin, whether you might be able to say a bit about, what is our approach to looking to help with this and, removing those barriers?
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, Georgina, I think it's what you said about being heard, being your own advocate, is so important because this is the thing that is coming up again and again, is about women being dismissed or minimized. And it's extremely common, particularly for period related or pain related symptoms. But yeah, so I also touched on the fact that there are these additional barriers as well, such as socioeconomic disadvantage, ethnicity, geography, disability, and differences in health literacy as well, that mean that women face much greater challenges in addressing care. And addressing these inequalities is a central focus of Warwick's approach. So one important issue to highlight is that women's healthcare in England is often fragmented and very difficult to navigate. So services are delivered across a variety of different settings, GP surgeries, hospitals, sexual health clinics, but they're also funded in different ways. So this means that women may have to go to multiple places for related care, for example, getting contraception, smear tests, or menopause support, all in different places. So this means that those facing additional barriers, this lack of joined up healthcare presents even more problems for them. So at Warwick, we're kind of addressing this in several different ways. This work is led by Bec Taylor, who's a public health doctor at Warwick, and she's led a national evaluation of the women's health hubs. So this the women's health hubs aim to bring services together so that they're more integrated and accessible. And Bec's research is helping to understand how these hubs are implemented across England to identify the issues, but also to understand what has worked well. But a key strength of Warwick's approach, as Andrew already mentioned, is that we're really trying to ground the research in women's real lived experience. So we had this amazing event on Friday that was led by Beck, that marked the launch of their report into different interventions across the Midlands, and an evaluation of those. But that work brought together researchers, clinicians, but also community groups. So for this piece of work, it was the Sisters organisation, and it was a truly powerful example of co-production with women, so that key stakeholders could really understand the impact experienced by these women, what their journeys had been like, and listening from their perspective. So it wasn't just a consultation, it was a genuine partnership with women with lived experience, and that's so important to shape questions, identify where services are not meeting needs, and co-design solutions. So I think Warwick's approach is about joining up systems, listening to women, and using evidence to redesign services.
And how do you feed that back? Because I can kind of everything you say, it makes so much sense. It seems like the art of the blindingly obvious, so to speak. But when the issues are so systemic, how do you feed that back into the system to bring about the systemic change that is needed?
Yeah, it's a really difficult question.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. But it might be useful to say something about because I was interested what you were talking about, the kind of the hubs. So can you tell us a bit more about them, about how they ca came about and kind of what the research and Beck's evidence is actually showing us?
Yeah, so this is where I really wish that Beck was here to help with this
Yay.
question. Sorry, this is not my area of expertise. But yeah, I think the key thing is that we are really waiting on
The results, it might be a wee bit early to say.
but we're also waiting on the new women's health strategy as well,
Right.
and how this is going to be taken forward.
Yeah, okay, great. Well, it's brilliant that we're kind of feeding into that. So, Andrew, a question for you as the token man. Joke on the panel, but as you mentioned, you've got a wife, you've got daughters, and you won't be obviously the only person who has that. So how can men kind of understand, support, and advocate for women's health needs?
Yeah, so I think the most important thing in all of this is we need to normalize conversations about women's health just generally. I mean, we need to get more comfortable talking about some of the issues. I go out with my friends cycling on a Sunday morning, and if I bring up, heavy menstrual bleeding or something and talk to them about women's health issues, it's challenging. Some people find it really difficult to talk about, and that's understandable. So I think there's a lot of work to do there for men who to talk about this stuff more, not just with men, but with their friends, whoever, it doesn't matter, but normalizing that's important. I think involving men in conversations about advocacy for women's health is really important as well. We shouldn't make it a women's only, it's not a women's only issue to think about this. This is everybody's issue, right? This affects all of us together. And by working together, we can make more of a difference. I think as a man, ultimately, it's, and we've heard a lot of it today already, but listen and believe lived experience. You've got to treat women's health concerns as real. They're not exaggerated, and they're also not normal. Suffering through perimenopause, you shouldn't just accept that as being, well, that's just the way it is, right? It doesn't necessarily need to be that way. That quality of life can and should be improved. So we have to remove those things from these conversations, and men have a really important place to play in that. I think that the men can use any roles that they have in leadership or decision making to be an advocate for research in women's health, right? You can actually do something real to actually try to make a difference, and that's important. And of course, there's the wider thing, which is of course a wider social construct about, just encouraging shared responsibility for reproductive caregiving roles, all of these things. It should be a joint endeavor. So women's health isn't just for women, right? I think that's the really important thing. And also, I have to say, I think men can challenge bias when you see it. So speak out against bias, especially things like dismissive language about pain. There's a view that pain isn't real if a woman has pain. It makes no sense, right? So call it out. Dismissive language. If people say, "Oh, well, it's just your hormones," like, no, that's not right. Let's talk about this in the right way. Let's understand the actual reality of these things. So overall, men active ally is what I think. I think men should be active allies in women's health. And I think if they could do that, we could improve things further.
And go to those appointments as well.
Yes.
It's much harder to dismiss symptoms if somebody else is sat in the room with you, witnessing that. So yeah, absolutely. Attend the appointments.
Well, isn't that interesting? Because part of me, when you kind of said that, I hadn't really so much thought it was about the kind of the witnessing, which of course is a really important point. I was more thinking it was because they might listen to the man. And, he might be needed to kind of back up and support, which was kind of feeling a bit kind of counterintuitive.
I mean, I think men are very good at complaining about their health and therefore are heard. And like I said, I think, women just don't complain as much because they are going to be minimized, and it does feel very frustrating to pick up. I remember when I was initially, investigating my diagnosis, and I reached out to the referring doctor, 2 years later, saying, "Look, it had come back as a malignant diagnosis." He WhatsApped me back saying, "Oh, I thought it was all done and dusted." That's how casual it was, his response to me saying that I had a breast cancer diagnosis. And that's how he felt. He literally felt that they had done the most investigation that they had done to the best of their ability at that time. And he didn't realize that it could be anything more sinister, which is crazy to me, because if he had found a lump in his scrotum, for example,
Yeah,
I don't
right.
think he would be so casual about it, you know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that is absolutely key. Now, going back to the research that we're doing in Warwick, and this is very much it is a very key plank of the philanthropic campaign, Set the Pace, which we announced about, I think it was at the beginning of the month. It was the official launch, though obviously we've been going through a kind of the quiet phase of it. I mean, do you think, Erin, obviously we must think that philanthropy has a role to play in this because it wouldn't be one of our key themes, but could you just expand for us why you think philanthropy could play such a kind of a vital role?
Absolutely. So at Warwick, we are tackling some of the biggest health challenges, the biggest unanswered questions in women's health. So our research is covering conditions such as endometriosis, infertility, recurrent pregnancy loss, preterm birth, breast cancer, menopause, and we've got some really amazing examples of the work that has been going on, where discoveries in the lab have changed the lives of women. So, for example, the work that has been done in Jan Brosen's lab and his implantation clinic at University Hospital Coventry in Warwickshire. Those findings have led to a groundbreaking new diagnostic for women with recurrent pregnancy loss. And this has changed the lives of hundreds to thousands of women attending that clinic. And in my own lab, we've made discoveries that have then like informed a clinical trial for a new immunotherapy for endometriosis. So we're really well poised to take that fundamental science all the way through to impact for women. And these are disorders that are historically underfunded and under-researched. But with philanthropy, it really can completely change our ability to move rapidly with these things, to just take those fundamental discoveries and run with that and to do the research that is life-changing for these women. So it can make a real difference. We can start new ideas earlier. We can build really important resources, like women's health biobanks, new technologies, platforms. But one of the key things as well is to help us retain exceptional researchers and clinicians at really pivotal stages in their careers. So when they're developing new ideas and building teams, these are quite precarious transition periods for researchers. And having funds from philanthropy can really help us retain researchers, but also female researchers, because they are also going through these life transitions, having children, and these like key points where they can drop out of academia. So philanthropy really has got the power to change the pace of progress, and help us move more quickly.
I think the other thing just to add is that, we were almost frustrated at some level because we have brilliant people doing brilliant work already in certain areas, but lots of things that we're not tackling yet. So I think there's a really huge opportunity for philanthropy to allow us to sort of like start to fill the gaps. I'm sure out of all the people listening today, they're probably thinking, but what about the condition that I have experienced that's not been talked about? Because there are many. And I think there's an opportunity to actually speak to that, and that's why I think bringing public patient together, what are the big challenges? Where do we really need to make a difference? And then let's find ways in which we can do that. Philanthropy also allows us to accelerate what we do. That means that we can get new tests. I mean, Erin's talking about new tests, but we need to get those tests adopted and diffused in the whole of the healthcare system. We need to have it, through to the NHS and so on and so forth. So there is a lot of work, a long journey that needs to happen for new interventions before they actually get to become a treatment that you can actually have available for everybody. So we need that full journey from the discovery to the actual, implementation of that into our healthcare systems, and then make sure all women have access. Right, ultimately, that's where we have to aim for and build the infrastructure to do that and think about it in that whole life cycle way. I think that's the bit which we really would like to do. And I think that's where philanthropy can make a big impact.
So you just introduced so many completely enticing concepts there. So not only did you kind of reference lots of the research that you're doing, and obviously we've heard some of the research that has been doing, you also referenced the research that you'd like to do. So can I take the first part of that and just ask you to expand, because I know there are so many people in the university doing this, and you've told us about some, but can you kind of share with us just kind of just tell us a bit about the kind of that wider range of research that's been done.
I think that we realized when we started the mission that there was brilliant stuff happening in places we didn't expect. So, for example, in chemistry, they're developing new patches for the delivery of hormones for treatment of postmenopausal conditions, for example. So really new innovative work that cuts across everything. This is where Warwick stands out. We have brilliant mathematicians and computer science historically. Those people now turning themselves to develop things like miscarriage support app through the Tommy's charity that allows women to understand what the risks are of recurrent miscarriage, informed by high-end science. That is the kind of thing that Warwick can do that I think makes it really stand out. So I think that kind of bringing together those different skill sets, bringing together patients in the public with the NHS colleagues as well, and together tackling these problems. And there are many examples of that. We also have colleagues in economics who are doing health economics work on how can we, because if we're going to improve the health system, it actually has to work, right? There is not, unfortunately, unlimited resource. So how can we improve the health economic modeling of these things such that we can get the best treatments to patients and to women across the world? That is the bit we can do by bringing together those. There's great work in the business school as well, looking at how you look at behavioral change and behavioral science and how that impacts how the barriers, women, the stigma that Erin talked about, not even, suffering from pelvic floor problems. I think the survey says 25% of women didn't even go and ask for help because they were embarrassed to do so, right? That's wrong. And we've got to create a world where those 25% of women do go and ask for help so they can actually improve their quality of life. So I think it's all of those things coming together that's super important.
It's very, very interesting talking about the kind of the wider, because we kind of tend to think it's all based up in Gibbet Hill, but actually what you're saying is it's not. So we'll come on to how those we pull that all together within Warwick, but I'm going to ask Erin just to expand as well about kind of the work that colleagues are doing, which I know you're kind of leading and pulling it all together, Erin, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And we've tried to collect a lot of the work that's going on the Women's Health Mission page. So yeah, we've highlighted some of the work that people are doing, but we absolutely haven't been able to cover everything. But for example, we've got amazing work going on in our clinical trials unit as well, where they're carrying out large scale trials in areas such as pregnancy and breast cancer, helping to test new interventions and improve patient outcomes. So yeah, absolutely do have a look at the Women's Health Mission page. There's a lot more examples on there of the work that we're doing, and yes, absolutely, just trying to invest in the future as well, and training the next generation of researchers. I know we touched on that a little bit with our medical students, but also
Yes.
training opportunities for clinicians, PhDs. We've got an MRes program, and a new MSc in women's health launching this year as well.
Oh,
So we're
that's good.
really trying to bring along that pipeline of talent, of researchers that are invested in the future of women's
Yeah.
health.
And it's interesting as well, because again, because we're talking about research quite a lot, but we're doing education in this area as well. And how did you, because Warwick is a big diverse community in terms of the research that it does. So you mentioned economics, you mentioned business school, you mentioned chemistry. So how did you find all of the areas of research, and how do you bring them together? What is this? What is the secret? Please tell.
Well, you can answer, Erin. I just really cared about this thing and how could we make a difference. And I knew my local colleagues who were working and are so brilliant, doing amazing stuff. And then we start to look slightly broader. But then we also held a kind of women's health, how to describe it, sort of in, like a day where people interested in women's health come along. We had some talks, present, talk about what we were doing. And there it was remarkable, because then people were coming and saying, oh, I'm doing this and I'm doing that. And we were like, we didn't even know you existed. So we have to be very proactive about it. We have to go out into the community and tell them we really care about women's health. We want to make a difference. We're going to do this. Who wants to join in, right? Who wants to be part of it? And I don't think that story's finished yet, because I think there are many colleagues across the university who also probably have brilliant ideas that could be applied to solving problems that are related to women's health. As I said right at the beginning, I didn't start off working in women's health. I started off working on how cells work, but could see how that actually could provide a route to improve things in this really important area. And I suspect there will be many more examples of that. We also, as a university, as a medical school now, we really have a focus on women's health reproductive science. So where we're looking to grow and recruit new academics and develop new courses, as Erin has said, we're bringing this degree of focus. We really want Warwick to be the place to do women's health, right? That's what success looks like. We create a place which is, that is the place to go, the place which actually try to make a difference, and that we can actually evidence that and see that actually happening. And if we can do that, then I think we've made a big step forward.
So, Georgina, can I ask you if you had, because and we will come back onto it as well about what else Andrew would like to do should he get that kind of
Yeah.
philanthropic income. So we'll talk about that in a minute. But if you had a magic wand, and I might call it a philanthropic magic wand, it doesn't matter anyway, a funding magic wand, and you could have a kind of a wish for an area that could be researched, what would that be?
I mean, I think the obvious answer would be for breast cancer, obviously, having personally gone through that. But also, I would also want to, if I had a magic wand, would be how information was dispersed to all countries that are dealing with the issues, and where progress is found in, more developed countries is given quickly to developing countries. Because one thing I found that was interesting, that even though I was dealing with the best hospital, in a country that has wealth, the treatment plan was completely different, and the diagnosing of the type of breast cancer that I had was, once again, The first step should have been always been a biopsy once there was a lump, and I never had a biopsy. I had a mammogram and ultrasound, and they felt that that was enough. So for me, the gaps in sort of information getting to developing countries is a bit strange, because I think we have less cases but poor outcomes, and that to me means clearly that medicine and medical attention and care isn't getting where it needs to be. And I think we also have that problem in the UK, because even in the 2 years that I have been treated, because of government policy, I may not have had access to some of the drugs that I am on now because of costs and expense. And there's no reason why some of these drugs should not be given as first line of treatments for everybody, especially when we take into consideration that everybody's life is important. So it'd be figuring, if I had a magic philanthropic wand, it would be to make sure that the money gets where it needs to get to, and the information is spread where it needs to be spread to. And yeah.
And of course, you raised, and I am conscious we're not out of time yet, so we've got time to explore. But I think you raised two very interesting points in that. One was when you said that there were lower levels of it, but the actual, diagnosis wasn't as thorough. So there's an interesting question to me about why the levels are, lower in that kind of preventative space. But it also raised for me a question about, and it had occurred to me earlier, because obviously we're looking at Warwick because it's a Warwick seminar and things, but I know that, we have loads and loads of international connections, as we have lots and lots of international alumni. So are we working with international partners to try and tackle this? And are the issues common? Erin or
Yeah, they're common. They are
Andrew
common,
both.
and they are common, right? They affect every woman on the planet, right? And I think that what Georgina related to before is a really important point, that we must look at how we can make sure that advances do reach all women wherever they happen to be living on this planet. That would be that's a really important thing. I mean, I think everybody who we have, we work, who have research programs, they're all collaborating with the other experts in the field that can really enable them to take the next step. Actually, both Erin and I both collaborate closely with colleagues in Edinburgh, University of Edinburgh, to do work that's crucial, to make progress. We sort of try to bring together the best expertise we need. We're all about, what does it take to solve the problem? That's at the heart of it. And if that means somebody in Edinburgh, then that's what we're going to do. I know we're building good relationships with, for example, WashU Medicine in the US. We have a big reproductive medicine activity there. So there's some really exciting opportunities to build sort of international bridges to do this. So yeah, there's a lot going on in that space at the moment. Erin, did you want to add anything on that one?
Well, though I'm just going to comment, you have actually made Scotland sound international.
Ah, oh, yes, that's true. I did, didn't
Yeah, you
I?
did. So, Erin,
Inadvertently.
any comments on that and the internet? And, is anybody actually getting it right internationally? I mean, and obviously, Andrea said that, it is a global problem. It's not just a kind of an English stroke UK problem. But, do we know anybody who's getting this right that we can learn from?
Well, I just want to reiterate that yes, absolutely. Warwick is very well networked in terms of collaborations with different NHS trusts and universities. But I think one of the difficult things with women's health for international collaboration is standardizing the clinical metadata that's collected alongside the samples that we do research on, which are so key to understanding, what's going on with these disorders. And I know in the field of endometriosis, there's been lots of initiatives to globally harmonize the information that is collected from women so that we can do proper international partnerships and research. And so that, we don't have this issue of things not being reproducible, or samples not being collected in the same way, or the information being missing. So, I think it's really important that we work globally to make sure that we are doing the right thing, collecting the right information and processing samples in the right way.
So that is, I mean, that's a fairly key issue, which you've just, obviously this is so complex because it's even just coming up now, but that kind of that. lack of consistency of data being collected across the world. I mean, that's a real hindrance. So I'm kind of, if I was giving myself the magic wand, the philanthropic magic wand, I think actually trying to, do some research or lead a project to try and lead to that standardization of data might be where I would kind of, put my pennies, wave my wand. So we are about to run out of time, but I think we've got room for one more question. So Andrew, you mentioned the one, you mentioned things that you would like to do that, if you had the funding, you would do. So in a sentence, and I'm going to ask each of you the same question, in a sentence, what would that be?
There's a few, but I would say that actually I learned that 75% of people suffering from autoimmune disorders are women. I think there's a huge piece of unknownness around autoimmune disorders and women's health, and I think it desperately needs research programs to be initiated in that space. I
Gosh,
would love to see us
wow.
do something like that. And autoimmunity crosses over into things like endometriosis as well. I think the role of the immune system and hormonal systems in women's health is a very important area to go for.
That's really, gosh, super interesting. Aaron?
Oh, sorry, can you
Yeah,
just
it's the if you had the
magic
one,
wand.
if you were given a bunch of funding to investigate one thing, new, which isn't being investigated at the moment, what would it be? And you
Yeah,
have literally 30 seconds before I wrap up.
absolutely. Understanding how different life transitions impact women's health. So, trying to understand how pregnancy complications can change outcomes in later life. So it's really important for us to have this kind of perspective on the health span as well and how.
Brilliant.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Right, we're running out. Well, my bad, Sharon. We're running out. Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much to our panelists. What I've heard is that this is a massive, massive, wide spending issue. And one of the key aspects of it is that we can only do this research if we do it with the women who are involved and if we listen to their voice and put them first. And what I'm kind of hearing is that we are doing that work, and that is brilliant. So we will share links to the latest Women's Health Healthcare. Erin mentioned the link, and thank you everybody for attending. Have a good rest of the day.